Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Mert Byrne of the El Dorado Animal Clinic about the day, a day in the life of a veterinarian. Right now, I would like to welcome Dr. David Sklar. He is Dean of Graduate Medical Education at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine, and he's author of the book La Clinica, A Doctor's Journey Across Borders, published by University of New Mexico Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Nice to be with you.
It's great to have you. What an interesting book. Before you went to medical school as a young man, just out of college, you became a volunteer at a clinic in Mexico where an American named Carl Wilson had set up basically the only medical facilities that were serving a village and a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't have had any medical attention. Tell us about the origins of this clinic and its founder, Carl Wilson.
Well, Carl actually went down there with some students as part of a biology field trip. And he encountered people who were sick and needed medication. And so some of the medications and bandages and so on they had brought along with them for themselves, they actually gave out to villagers. And as that went on and people were so grateful for what they were doing, he got an invitation to return and essentially to be the doctor for the village. And this was a very isolated rural part of Mexico, where there were no other doctors. There were some curanderos and other native healers, but no physicians, formal kinds of doctors.
Wilson is such an interesting character. I mean, you arrive there as at age 21, you're about to go to medical school, and then he tells you, oh, medical school's a big waste of time, it's all about hospitals and power and money. And then he proceeded to give you, who hadn't even, you'd never been a doctor, far more responsibility than you ever dreamed of. That's a whole different kind of medical education. Tell us about that, how you learned to treat patients.
Well, yeah, I think Wilson really believed that if we were going to really do anything about getting health care out to people in rural areas, that doctors were not really the way to do it, that you needed to train other kinds of people who would actually stay in these villages. The doctors were going to mostly be pulled to the cities and so on. And I think his vision was to try to actually train students and people from the village to ultimately provide care, as well as have people learn how to treat themselves. Now, when I got there, I didn't realize what I'd be getting myself into, and I thought I was mostly going to be helping doctors and others who had also volunteered there. But after a fairly short period of time, the people who I went to help, I had to come back to the United States to try to get donations and support for the clinic or come back and work. And so after a few weeks there, I was left with basically a building with medications and some equipment and told to just do the best I could and read the books and that it would be better than nothing.
And so there you were, a very young man who'd never, really never treated patients at all, having patients come in saying, David, ayúdanos, whatever, and you would say, okay, come on in, what are your symptoms? And you'd open a book and you'd read. You'd make a diagnosis, you'd read, and that didn't seem to bother them.
Well, it didn't. I mean, it was sort of remarkable to me that actually most of the time when I did that, it generally worked. I mean, I did have my failures for sure, and then there were those times when people came in with sort of things like they were being felt like they'd been bewitched or something like that, and there was really nothing in my books for that kind of thing, and I had to sort of just play it by ear and decide how far I was willing to go. And, I found myself sometimes going further than I probably would have ever imagined I would, just because I thought that if I didn't do that, the effect on the person might be very serious. In fact, with the bewitching issue, if someone could not find another person to help counteract a spell or something like that, then they would try to kill the person that they thought had bewitched them. And I didn't think that was a particularly appropriate way to resolve the problem.
And so instead, you actually made up rituals that involved shaking bottles of talcum powder and dancing and just making up words. And they believed you, and it worked.
Well, yeah, I was pretty creative. I mean, as I say, now that I think about it, it sort of shocks me that I actually went that far. But, I think at least for the people that I was involved with, I think they felt like what I had done was effective for the problem. You know, this one particular woman felt like she had a frog in her stomach, and actually felt like what I had done was effective. Although I then sort of covered my bases by giving her a little what I call an amulet with some Valium pills to wear around her neck, just in case, so that if the frog came back, she could open it up and swallow the pills. So I wasn't that confident that my ceremony was really going to be effective over the long haul.
It is very funny. I mean, for me, I was reading that and I was thinking of the time I'd spent in Latin America hearing stories of bewitching in Peru and Cuba and Mexico and all these places. Did you ever feel that there was anything besides just pure superstition to all of that?
Well, I think there's a lot of things we don't really fully understand. And there's, you know, the connection between our mind and our bodies, you know, is not always as clear to us, I think, as we would like it to be. And so I do think that there were clearly times when people had physical manifestations of illnesses that were, you know, somewhat psychological and probably somewhat physical, and that doing something that would speak to both the mind and the body was the only way that we were ever going to really actually cause the person to get over the problem. I think it's something in our Western healthcare system that we probably don't pay enough attention to, but it was clearly an element for a lot of the people that I took care of.
We're talking to Dr. David Sklar, author of La Clinica, A Doctor's Journey Across Borders. So back to Carl Wilson, what was his vision for public health? And, well, you've started to explain it a little bit, and how was this clinic a part of it?
Well, I think he saw the clinic as sort of a way into the community to actually help do overall community development. And I think that his vision is probably correct. I don't think you can cure all of the medical problems or even address a lot of them if you don't address the issues like clean water and nutrition and just kind of cooperation between people. And so I think his thought was that if he opened up this clinic, that people would come to trust him and trust the people who were there, and that then they would be willing to work together to change some of the other conditions that were affecting their health, as vaccination, water, nutrition, all of that. And so that was sort of the goal overall.
You were, as you said, you were left alone without medical training, and you were called out to actually take a ride by mule to a woman who was having a complicated childbirth. That was a very scary moment for you. You'd never even given a woman a pelvic exam.
Right. That was probably one of the scariest moments that I had. I was very fortunate that there was a midwife there who essentially did all the work in delivering the baby, but they asked me to come because the labor had sort of gotten held up, and the baby was, you know, it just wasn't progressing the way it was supposed to. And I brought books, and I actually brought another a student who was actually down there visiting, and I thought, well, you know, we'll just try to do the best we can, because it didn't seem like there were any other alternatives. But now, looking back on it, I'm really not sure what I would have done had the woman required something like a C-section. I think it would have probably been a disaster. I was just very fortunate that the midwife was able to achieve the delivery.
What was your relationship like with people like midwives and the local curanderos?
Oh, I think most of them actually were pretty supportive. I think they just saw me as another adjunct to what they were providing. Most of the time, the midwives wouldn't even call us until later on, maybe to examine the baby or the mother or something like that. But most of the time, they would manage the births themselves. And as far as the curanderos went, I think they felt like they had their system and we had our system, and if people wanted to try both, then that was sort of fine with them, as long as they were able to continue to do what they believed in. And it was sort of just a slightly different or totally different belief system that they had about, you know, different kinds of hot and cold diseases and remedies that would sort of help put people back into a balance. It was sort of this balance that got disrupted that they were trying to reestablish. And we didn't really see things in quite that way. For us, it was more, you know, there's a bacteria that causes an illness and we'll give an antibiotic to kill the bacteria. So I think there was a very different philosophical basis for the two approaches.
The first patient of yours who died was a diabetes patient. How did this affect you?
Oh, well, it was really quite horrible. It was a young man who was a musician in the community. He was not totally normal. I think mentally he probably was more like maybe about a 10-year-old. He was an adult, but he was not mentally an adult, but he was very well regarded in the community for his singing. And I did not realize that he had diabetic ketoacidosis. He came in with trouble breathing, which can be one of the signs of ketoacidosis. It can also be a sign of pneumonia or respiratory disease. And so I looked at my books, and it sounded like respiratory disease, and gave him some antibiotics. And unfortunately, that wasn't the problem. It turned out to be his ketoacidosis. And unfortunately, we all make mistakes like that, but I really wasn't prepared for it at all. And I guess I thought that a death would tend to be a more expected, someone who had cancer or something where you would expect them to die. I really wasn't prepared for someone to die and sort of unexpectedly like that.
It was, it's interesting because working in Mexico, one of the things that softened that and many other cases that you had was the pervasive belief in destiny and in the will of God. They never blamed you for your mistakes, even as you were blaming yourself.
Well, that's absolutely right. In fact, they were more accepting of that than I was, and I think their feeling was that this was really the will of God, and all I could do, all anybody in medicine could do, would be maybe to help ease, people's way along toward their meeting with God, but that we really couldn't change destiny, that was what it would be. And so I think they were actually grateful for what I had done. I felt like I had not done anything helpful at all. And in fact, that was the case in most of the deaths that I participated in, that people were very appreciative and accepting of everything that I could do. I had a woman who had tetanus, and she would have died in the U.S. or anywhere, but it was not something you would expect to take care of in a little village, but I basically tried to make her comfortable. And in this country, it's usually a very different kind of experience when someone dies or is dying. I think the expectation is that our healthcare system should be able to change that, should alter it, and that nobody should really die until things have gotten to a terrible place, where death is obviously the only outcome. But that's just not the way it is. We don't know that much that we can always anticipate who has a fatal illness or a very serious problem. There's a lot of uncertainty in medicine, and I think in our country here, we tend not to be quite as accepting of the uncertainty and, just the limited nature of what we can do as doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers.
We're talking to Dr. David Sklar, author of the book La Clinica, A Doctor's Journey Across Borders. And a good chunk of the book is about your time at La Clinica when you were a young man, but the other half of it is about a time when you were older, and the story is interwoven with your own personal story of your marriage falling apart, and also a lot of really interesting passages about being an emergency room doctor. The emergency medicine that you practiced as an emergency room doctor, did you go into that as a result of your work in Mexico?
Well, that's a great question, and I've often wondered about that. I think that there are some similarities in that in the emergency department, we often are confronted with situations that we can't really anticipate, and sometimes we don't have as much equipment as we would like, and we have to just sort of make do, make the best we can, and be creative. And I think that was also the way it was for me in Mexico. And so I guess that I was familiar with that situation, and I felt like in some ways maybe I could do more for people because I wasn't afraid of sort of the uncertainty and the unknown, and I was willing to try to work with whatever I had to try to address whatever the problem was. So, I think the emergency department maybe was a natural place for me to go. Later on when I did go back, I went back to that clinic in Mexico because I was sort of just re-looking at my life in general, whether my career and also my personal life, and trying to figure out how things had turned out the way they had. I was sort of having some questions about my career in emergency medicine, wondering if I actually was doing enough, and then wondering how my marriage had not succeeded because I felt like I'd worked hard, I'd been a good husband, good dad, and what had happened, what had I done to end up this way. And so I did go back to the village, and part of the book is about that return and what I found. And of course I found that the clinic was not doing very well. It was basically falling apart for a lot of reasons. And also a lot of the answers that I thought I would find there, I really didn't find. But then I actually met up with the people who I'd lived with, family that I was very close to, and they sort of reassured me partly through their own story. Their own son had been kidnapped by people and held for ransom, and they had to essentially give up everything they had. They had to sell their home and all their property, everything they had, to get him back. And of course, I would have thought that they were incredibly, disturbed by that, and that they maybe felt like their whole lives, their livelihood, everything was gone. But in fact, it wasn't the case. The dad said, "No, I'm going to rebuild my life better than it was, and I have my son back, and I have the love of my family, and I have so much. My life is so rich, and that essentially that's what I took back from that I could do the same thing, that I could come back, and that in fact I did have a lot to come back to, and even my career, even though I sometimes didn't accomplish as much as I maybe would have liked to, that there was an awful lot that I was doing and helping people, and that maybe I needed to not be quite so tough on myself."
One of the things that was interesting and quite horrifying was that when you went back to the clinic, or to the town, the village where the clinic had been, it wasn't really there anymore in the same way. The biggest public health problem was no longer illness; it was violence.
Yes, yeah. What had happened was, of course, when we'd first gotten down there, it was illness associated with unclean water, and so water system, you could fix that. But then what happened was that a lot of the drug growing occurred in that particular part of Mexico, and associated with the growing of marijuana and opium was a lot of people who came in with guns and sort of a violent lifestyle that changed the lives for everybody. I think all of the people who used to go up into the mountains with their cows and growing corn and so on were really very frightened, we're not sure whether they were going to be able to continue to live in the village because their own safety and the safety of their families had been put at risk. And I wasn't really prepared for that, and wasn't really sure how a clinic was going to be able to address problems like that.
What happened to Carl Wilson? Did he realize in any way his dream of training local people to actually become doctors or to become healthcare workers that were doing the kind of work that he did in villages?
Well, Carl, of course, it's a very long story with him, but he did get several of the young people from the village to get interested in medical careers, and actually one or two of them stayed there and continued to provide some health care. But I think that the larger influence for Carl was that he ended up writing about what he had done and some of his ideas, and his writings ended up really spreading all over the world and influencing people in countries all over the world who were facing some of the same problems. And they sort of used his writings to be sort of a roadmap to develop healthcare models in developing parts of the world and in rural communities. So I think in that way, he did succeed, and I think he also was able to demonstrate that a clinic by itself, without a larger perspective of a community and community development, is probably not going to be adequate. That you really do need to look at the larger picture. So, and in that way, he did succeed. I think that the building, La Clinica, did go away, and so in that way, you could say it ultimately didn't succeed. But when you think about the fact that this is one person who kind of got it all going and on really a shoestring, very little money, and he drew to him lots of people like myself, other volunteers who came down and donated time and energy and creativity and enthusiasm, I think in that way it really showed how much one person can actually do. It may not be exactly what you thought you were going to do, but it's enormous with, again, the right and being in the right place at the right time with the right kind of vision, how much you can actually do.
What was it like for you to go to medical school after being at the clinic in Mexico?
Well, it was a little tricky because I actually thought I knew more than I did. I had actually taken care of fairly sick people, and most of them had gotten better, so I sort of resisted some of the basic science teaching because it didn't seem relevant to me at first, and I thought that I should probably just be able to almost be exempted from some of that and move on to some of the clerkships like the pediatrics and medicine and things like that. But I learned quite quickly that even though the basic sciences of medicine they aren't really necessary for a lot of what you can do in medical care, there's probably 10 or 15% of the diseases that we see that if you don't really understand the basic foundations of pathophysiology and anatomy and microbiology, that you are going to make mistakes. And that, certainly in our country, we really couldn't tolerate that level of uncertainty or correctness. I mean, you really have to be right much more than just 80% or 75% of the time. It might have been acceptable in that little village in Mexico where there were no other choices to get it right most of the time, but it wasn't acceptable in a modern medical center in the United States.
Well, and also with the pervasive attitude here that we have the right to be cured, and if we're not, we have the right to sue the person who didn't cure us.
Well, that's right, and it is interesting. I mean, certainly, I don't always think about people suing me when I take care of them in the emergency department, but it does sort of hang over our heads, and it wasn't something I thought about in Mexico. I basically, whatever I could do, people were grateful for it, and I think they realized that I had my limitations. But if they were to have gone to a doctor in the big city, which was 3 or 4 hours away, the cost would have been prohibitive. They might have had to sell their farm, or they would have lost what was really their most important property, their horse or cows or mules, which is what would sustain them. So I think they were sort of willing to receive what I could give. I think in our country here, I think the expectations are just far more, and as you say, if things don't go well, I think there's sort of a sense that it's got to be somebody's fault. Now, I don't believe that's true. I don't think it's always somebody's fault. I think sometimes things just are going to turn out a certain way, and there's not that much that we can do to change that. But I think, unfortunately, that many of the people who show up in emergency departments, that's sort of how they believe it should be.
So in Mexico, you know, poor people are having their children kidnapped and paying horrible ransoms, and there's violence of a kind that really was not there when you were a young man in medical school. Now, what, I guess 20, 30 years ago by this time.
Right.
But in Albuquerque, at the hospital there, a lot of the problems that you saw were also caused by violence and other social ills. I mean, the book starts with three young teenage gang members, and two out of three of them die. And you make the observation that one of them had braces on his teeth that his parents had clearly spent thousands of dollars on. And here are these people whose lives are wasted because of violence, a different violence than in Mexico, but really not that different.
Well, that's right. And I think it's one of the tragedies in our own society that so many of the problems that I take care of in the emergency department are really very preventable, whether it's drinking and driving, or whether it's alcohol-associated violence or gang kind of violence or domestic violence. It just seems to me that if our social fabric were a little different or a little more supportive, if we were able to address the issues by getting people into alcohol treatment or drug treatment or doing things to support families, that maybe a lot of the cases that I would see in the emergency department might not end up there, that maybe we could prevent them and avoid people ending up with serious injuries and problems that are pretty tough to solve.
As a child, you wanted to be a rabbi. Do you think that the feeling that made you want to be a rabbi has permeated into the way that you practice medicine?
Well, I think so. I mean, being a rabbi in my mind was being scholarly and trying to understand what people needed and to try to minister to their both their physical and their emotional needs. And I guess that, the way I practice medicine, I try to do that. I think as I've gotten older, I probably spend a lot more time thinking about the psychological and the emotional aspects of illness than I probably did when I was, a medical student just learning, the basic science of medicine. And I think that rabbis, I think, or at least I try to think of them as people who are, they have wisdom and they have a commitment to a community. And I think that's sort of how I like to try to see myself as now a somewhat aging emergency physician, that I've certainly had a commitment to this community, and I perhaps now try to approach problems with a little bit more thought and wisdom than maybe I did when I first started out.
David Sklar is the Dean of Graduate Medicine, the Dean of Graduate Medical Education at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine, and he's author of the book La Clinica, A Doctor's Journey Across Borders, published by the University of New Mexico Press. Dr. Sklar, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe today.
Thank you very much for interviewing me.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome Dr. Mert Byrne. He's the director of the El Dorado Animal Clinic, and he will lead an open student discussion called A Day in the Life of a Veterinarian at the Georgia O'Keeffe Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue in Santa Fe, from 6 to 7:30 in the evening this Wednesday night. It's a free event. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So how did you decide to become a veterinarian?
Well, I guess I, like most veterinarians, kind of wanted to do this my whole life. As a young man, I was always very fond of hanging around any four-legged or eight-legged creature that I could get my hands on. And as I got older and got interested in science and biology, it seemed to me a very cool way to combine something that I loved as a kid, the animals, and the science and biology of what I was finding to be true in the world itself. And it just seemed like a logical step to go to.
Doctors have to learn, human doctors have to learn all about the human body, but we're one species. Veterinarians have to learn about so many different animals. How deep do you go when you're trained into each species that you have to learn about? Dogs, cats, cows, horses, you've got birds, reptiles. What's the training like?
Yeah, it's difficult. And certainly, as you said, there are literally thousands of different species that we at least get some exposure to. Certainly, we really concentrate on the ones that we see a lot of, dogs, cats, and horses. When I was in vet school 20 years ago, we did learn about everything. We tried to stuff in as much as we could. These days, because there's so much more information, and the amount of information doubles every few years, it's just almost too much. So students in vet schools these days actually decide at some point, usually their freshman or sophomore year, about which track they will study, whether they will do horses, they will do what are called companion animals, dogs and cats. There's an exotics, and then there's the farm animals. There's also the wildlife and marine, and some schools concentrate a little more on that. So obviously there's an awful lot that has to be done after the typical 4 years of vet school is completed. But it is a very, very grueling, and I always think that human physicians have it kind of easy to only have to learn one species.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess if you are if you're a student and you want to be a wildlife veterinarian, you really have to choose what school you're going to even apply to.
Well, there are certain schools that do concentrate in some of those areas more stringently than others. But I think most of the people who end up in the zoos probably come out with the same training that I had. In fact, that was one of the things I wanted to do as going into Colorado State University, where I graduated after working at the Rio Grande Zoo in Albuquerque for many, many years. I thought that I would become a zoo vet. So the training is similar. Most of the specialized stuff you will do kind of on your own. But you know, one thing you do find, though, and I would say the same thing, even including humans, is that a lot of this, the biology and the anatomy is kind of the same. The bone structure is very similar between a human and a dog, or a cat, or a horse. There's certainly the bones. The same bones are all there. There are some changes and some specialization that you learn about that you concentrate on, but there's so much similarity that I think the more you learn about it, the more you appreciate how truly we are very, very related.
We're talking to Dr. Mert Byrne, veterinarian at the El Dorado Animal Clinic. So the knowledge that there is, veterinary knowledge, doubles every few years, as you said. What's the nature of that, of the new knowledge, new diagnoses and treatments, or what?
Well, I think all of that. Certainly there are many new treatments and new medicines coming out every day. But our knowledge about the physiology and the structure, and now that we're getting into genomes, it's a brave new and very, very exciting world out there. I think there's so much very, very cool information coming out that the future for medicine is truly very, very bright.
An animal can't talk to tell you what's wrong with them, so, or where the pain is, even. So what are the methods of diagnosis you use? Let's say somebody brings in an animal, and all you know is that the animal doesn't want to eat.
Yeah, and that's obviously something we deal a lot with, and it's certainly what makes one of the things that makes our profession so difficult. We concentrate a lot on getting a good history from the owners, and the owners know a lot more than sometimes they realize they do, and part of our job is trying to get those answers out of them. And then from that point, then we start with our physical examinations. We certainly have access to radiology and endoscopy and ultrasound. We've got a complete blood profile, both chemistries and CBCs here at the clinic. So we can get a pretty good amount of information very quickly. That's part of what I think veterinarians have had to do, is that we at our clinics, unlike your doctor, where you may go and then he may send you someplace else for blood work or radiology, we try to do that all here so we can get as much information as quickly as we can and try to get to a course of treatment as quickly as we can. But you're right. It is difficult, and we all I think all doctors, human physicians included, when you get out of school, you really don't know that much. And it's truly an art, certainly in veterinary medicine, about trying to take a patient and get to a diagnosis as quickly as you can. And as inexpensively, too, because many of these things can be very, very expensive. And so our clients are aware of that, and we try to get to where we need to go as frugally as we possibly can.
We're talking to veterinarian Mert Byrne, director of the El Dorado Animal Clinic. It's interesting because just before you on this show, we had a doctor on named Dr. David Sklar, who was an emergency room doctor for many years. And he tells a story in the book of this moment where a woman comes in and they don't know what's wrong with her, but he knows by looking at her that it's very serious and that it's probably her heart. And that's what it was, and she ended up dying of a heart attack. And people asked him, how did you know? And he said, I don't know, I just knew. That kind of intuition based on years of experience must happen to you, too, with animals.
Yeah, it certainly does. And many times, after hearing a couple of symptoms, I've got a track where I'm going to head with that particular a patient. But yeah, you do get a feeling and many times it can be a look in their eyes or the way they move in the room or things that they're concentrating on that will help us to kind of focus on where exactly the problem is. But yeah, there's an awful lot of intuition that goes into this, and that's why I feel like every year I'm a little bit better veterinarian. And I don't know how much longer that can keep up, but I do know that experience is very, very valuable in this profession.
What are some of the more difficult cases that you've ever had?
Well, I used to do a lot of exotics, and those are truly, I find, the very difficult animals. A lot of dogs and cats are kind of, they've been domesticated for a long time, and they're comfortable around humans. And you know, many cats will go up and vomit on your bed when they're not feeling well to kind of give you that heads up. Whereas exotics do just the opposite. They try to act healthy when they're really sick.
What do you mean by exotics?
Oh, birds, reptiles, amphibians. So you know, mostly I did a lot of parrots when I first came to Santa Fe. I do very few now, but I used to do, and snakes and lizards. And again, their whole approach to their environment is very, very different than the domestic animals, the dogs and cats and pets that we see. And that, again, of course, makes the diagnosis on those guys extremely difficult. But, you know, dogs and cats is certainly what I do 95% of. And we see a lot of hit by cars is probably the most traumatic events that we see in dogs and cats, and obviously that's a situation where dogs and cats tend to come out on the bad end, and fractures of every bone we've certainly seen, and we like all the hospitals will approach these the same way, and we now have a whole setup of a referral systems with specialists in New Mexico that we're very fortunate to have. So for some of these very serious bone injuries, we can ship these guys down to Albuquerque, or actually there's a group that's coming up here to Santa Fe now that we can get them to help us out on these more complicated situations. But total hip replacements and elbow replacements, all these things that are commonly done in our geriatric human patients are something we're now doing in animals.
Another question, it's interesting, it came up in the previous conversation that we just had on this program, was some people have the attitude when there is illness and death, it's God's will. Other people have the attitude, it's up to the doctor. We basically demand a cure. And part of that is a cultural difference. And with animals, it's different from humans, or maybe not. I mean, do you feel that people are willing to let their animals go when an illness comes, when the animal's life cycle has really come to a close?
Yeah, no, I do think that is something that has changed, certainly, and even in the 20 years I've been doing this, is that I think dogs and cats, and that's maybe what I should talk most about, since that's what I know most about, have become more of a part of the family. And again, it is different, and it is different culturally. And some individuals, you know, it's just a dog or a cat, and their connection is not very deep. But many of my clients, it is a part of their family, and I realize that. I've got a lot of older patients who have the only reason that they get up in the morning is to feed their dog or their cat. And I, when those dogs and cats are sick, that's something I really concentrate very hard on pulling those guys through, like we do with all animals. But I do feel more pressure with some of my clients. But to answer your question, yeah, I think that the approach that can be very different, and that's something that we try to as a veterinarian to figure out how far some individuals would like us to go. And I'm pretty upfront with some people and tell them, here's what the problem is, here's what it might cost, here's how the outcome may be. Obviously, you can never guarantee any of that, and then help them make the decisions. And quite realistically, money comes into that quite often, because some treatments and areas that we will follow to try to get to a cure can be extremely expensive.
But it's not like you've got, you know, a dachshund on dialysis or life support or something like that, where a human or, you know, a German shepherd sitting in a coma for 20 years or situations like that.
That's true. And you know, I think part of what we can do as veterinarians that we cannot do as humans, and I'm not trying to make any cultural, ethical statements here, but we have the advantage to euthanize these creatures when the outlook is very gloom, when there's no hope, then we can, and the animal's in pain, that we can make those decisions. That is a huge thing, I think, that we have in veterinary medicine. And again, I don't I've got many clients who have different opinions about this, and I've never recommended anyone to euthanize an animal. I've never tried to talk anybody out of it. If someone's come to say it's time, it's an extremely difficult area to get into. It is an extremely difficult decision for humans to make to call the end to a member of their family. I think on the human side, we don't have to make those calls very often. And again, legally, most times you cannot make those calls. But we can with dogs and cats, which changes things a bit. But it is an extremely difficult thing.
Well, it's interesting because I recently had a Buddhist teacher on the air, a Rinpoche from Tibet, trained in Tibet, a very high spiritual teacher.
Uh-huh.
And I went to his talk, and somebody asked the question, in Buddhism, is it allowed to euthanize an animal that's in suffering? Because there's a total prohibition on all killing. And it was so interesting because his answer was basically, it's such a difficult decision that it ends up being an individual decision, and I can't tell you what's right and what's wrong with that, even in a religion that prohibits all killing.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Boy, and I'd sure agree with that. And again, unfortunately, but obviously, it is something I do probably every day. Many times people come to me and say, that must be the hardest part of your job, but I don't find that to be true. It is probably, and I say this a lot, the most humane thing I do as a human being.
Right.
And many times I am honored to be giving the trust by my clients to do that final injection. And in most of these situations, it is something that I am, again, I feel like it is a humane thing to do. Now, I also worked at the shelter for many years, and I euthanized literally thousands of dogs and cats who didn't need to die, and that is a very, very different thing and an extremely difficult time of my professional career when I was dealing a lot with that. But right. when I feel like I am truly helping an animal to move out of pain and I don't spiritually and religiously make no statements, but I'm usually very honored to do that for my clients and my patients.
We're talking to veterinarian Dr. Mert Byrne, who will be speaking tomorrow night, Wednesday, December 10th, from 6 to 7:30 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Education Annex. It's part of the Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. We'll talk about that more in just a few minutes. So euthanizing animals is not the hardest part of your job. What is?
Well, I think diagnostics. I mean, I think, again, like we were talking earlier, when I get a pet coming in with vague symptoms and trying to take those symptoms and coming up with a diagnosis, and especially, you know, when the pressure's on, when this animal is critical and they're blue and they're having problems getting a breath, is it the heart, is it the lungs, is it circulatory, is it neurological, is there a stroke or a tumor, all those things that I'm trying to make sense of with very little information is difficult. And again, a lot of times I realize that I don't have a day to figure this out. I've got maybe minutes or hours, and the difference can be obviously the difference between living or dying. So yeah,
how have the diagnostic tools changed in the time that you've been doing veterinary medicine?
Well, maybe the most significant one we have now is ultrasound, which is very nice. It allows us to without traumatizing the patient to be able to look inside. Radiology is something X-rays, something we've had certainly for 40 years, and I've always had an X-ray machine, and those are extremely helpful. The machines that read blood and tell me about different kinds of chemistries have they're extremely expensive when I got out of school, and now that's changed a lot. And almost all clinics have their own in-house laboratory now, so we can get an awful lot of information. I can, you know, I can look and give you the white blood cell count in the blood in a matter of minutes, and those things are very, very helpful. And I think our degree and certainly, you know, part of what I'm really impressed with is the veterinary technician program. So I've got really good help now too. So I can feel comfortable with bringing an animal back and saying I need this and X-rays and know that that's going to be done quickly and appropriately, and that I'm going to have some answers that I can concentrate on doing my job a little bit better without having to put in catheters and draw blood and do those things.
We've got just about a minute left. What are one or two things that you think people should know about their animals that would help prevent problems besides getting their vaccinations and heartworm prevention?
Well, in diet, I think, you know, and I say this to answer that question specifically, I think the two most important things that I see that I've kind of been putting this theory together in my head now for the last 10 years with the animals who really live a long time, I think the very most important thing is good weight control, and this is maybe in humans too. But obesity is a huge problem in our pets, and every week somebody brings me in a dog that is of good weight and say, I think he's got worms, I can't put weight on him. And again, that's not the goal. Keeping these guys lean is really correlates well with a long life. The other thing is good oral health and good clean teeth, and that's as much genetics as it is diet or anything else. I think keeping your animals lean and keeping good oral health are two really important factors that will enable them to live a good, long life.
My little dog, Honey, the Jack Russell Terrier, weighed at some point 26 and a half pounds. She was utterly obese, and we just gave her a regimen of diet and exercise, and now she weighs 19 pounds.
That's
it really
great.
Is. It's not that hard to get your dog to lose weight. It's harder than doing it yourself.
Yeah, I think that's true. It isn't that hard. But Bennett, you probably added years to her life. I really feel like that's true.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Dr. Mert Byrne is the director of the El Dorado Animal Clinic, and he will be leading an open discussion for students or anybody else called A Day in the Life of a Veterinarian. It's at the Georgia O'Keeffe Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue in Santa Fe from 6 to 7:30 Wednesday night, tomorrow night. And everybody's welcome. There's seating preference for students, and it's free admission with refreshments. And this is all part of the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Nick Iapolucci for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.